Thank you very much, Barbara, and thank you for inviting me to come and speak here today. I took it as my goal of this talk to just give you some idea, I mean, of what kinds of mathematics that it might be possible that you could be thinking about if you go on to graduate school, and then also, you know, if you happen to go to McMaster, what you might find yourself thinking of there, and also just to tell you about some kind of fun mathematics. This is a project that I was working on a couple of years ago, and it's a nice idea, and I think it's sort of just an interesting thing to hear about. So, an infinite pigeonhole principle. Now, if you think about a pigeonhole principle, of course, immediately that sounds somewhat contradictory, because after all, the pigeonhole principle is a very much a finiteness kind of statement. The pigeonhole principle says, can everybody read that? If I have a function from a set with n plus 1 elements to a set with n elements, then it must be injective. It must be not injective. And the point is that if you have n plus 1 pigeons and you try to put them into n holes, then you have to put at least 2 into one of those holes. All right, so another way of saying this would be that if I have any finite set and I have a function from that set to itself minus a point, that function is not injective. On the other hand, if I have an infinite set, then there certainly will be a bijection, a function which is both injective and surjective from that set to a proper subset of itself. And that, in fact, we can take as the definition of a set being infinite. And if you get bored with anything else I'm saying, you can ponder whether you can write down any other definition of what it means for a set to be infinite. So, okay, there is no infinite pigeonhole principle. Infinite sets do not have a pigeonhole principle. But the function that you have to write down might be in some ways very unnatural. It could be a very cumbersome function. So I want you to consider the following situation. If I look at a subset of the complex numbers, c to the n, a constructible set, that means I take polynomials, and I take zero sets of polynomials. I look at the set of x for which a polynomial is equal to zero. I take unions of sets like that, intersections, complements. This gives me a class of sets which is called the constructible sets. And these are the sets that one deals with in algebraic geometry. And there's a theorem which says if I have a function from a constructible set to itself, which is a polynomial mapping, so I'm not allowing just any kind of function, but a function which is in some way defined by polynomials, then if that function is injective, then it's surjective. So there is no function from a constructible set to itself minus a point, which is injective. If the function goes from x to x and it's injective, then it's actually surjective. So if I look, I seem in some way to be expressing now some kind of pigeonhole principle. I'm talking about a function from an infinite set to itself, and yet I cannot get such a function, a nice function, which is from the set to itself minus a point, which is injective. So if we look among the class of, if I restrict my class of functions, then I can come up with something which looks like a pigeonhole principle. So what I want to do is to say, instead of just looking at, you know, sort of a set infinite sets, but allowing any old functions, I want to somehow restrict my class of functions in some way which is natural. And then talk about whether or not I can have this kind of statement which says that there is no map from a set to itself minus a point within that collection of functions. So I'm going to start with a fairly informal definition here. Let me suppose I'm talking about some collection of sets. And let's make it reasonably large, so we're making some statement that has some kind of content. So we'll take a large collection of sets. Let's have it closed under unions, intersections, Cartesian products, projection. I'd like to be able to take a set in n plus 1 space and map it down to a set in n space and have that still in my collection of sets. And let me suppose I've got a large collection of functions. I mean, this is going to be more interesting the larger my collection of functions is, but I want it to be in some way natural for that class of sets. So my functions should be defined on sets in S. They'll map a set in S in my collection of sets to another set in my collection of sets. And I'll assume that it contains all reasonable things, identity, projection, closed under inverses, composition. So I've got a reasonable class of functions that I'm talking about. Then I'll say that this set of sets, this collection of sets, and this collection of functions has an infinite pigeonhole principle. If there is no set, infinite set in the set, and no function in my class of functions, which is an injective function from my set Z to the set Z minus a point. Okay? So this is going to be what I consider to be an infinite pigeonhole principle. I can't take a set and map it to itself minus a point by a function which is injective. Okay, so this is a nice idea. Let's see, where do we have examples of this going on? If I take my set S to be the collection of all finite sets, and my set of functions to be all functions on finite sets, then the pigeonhole principle says that this, in this case, I have the infinite pigeonhole principle. I have this pigeonhole principle. That's my paradigm example, the finite sets. But Axe's theorem also says that if I take our set S to be the set of constructible subsets of the complex numbers, C to the N, and this family of functions to be all polynomial mappings, then this collection, this set of functions and this set of sets has a pigeonhole principle. I cannot get an injective function in this class of sets, in this class of functions, which maps a set to itself minus a point. Okay, well, if I have this kind of situation, I want to express it now in a different way. If I have such a collection of sets S, I can put an equivalence relation on this set by saying that two sets are equivalent if and only if there's a bijection in my family of functions from X to Y. And then I can look at the set of all the equivalence classes under this equivalence relation, and I have some kind of object. I've got my set, my class of sets, and I've modded out by this equivalence relation. Well, on this set of equivalence classes, I can define an addition and a multiplication in a reasonably natural way. I'll define X, the class of X plus the class of Y, to be the class of X union Y, where I take that so that X and Y are disjoint. So I have to do something to think about how to make sure that the representatives of the classes that I'm looking at are actually disjoint. I'll define the product using the Cartesian product. So the class of X times the class of Y is the class of the Cartesian product of X and Y. And this forces me then to have that I get a set which acts like a zero, which is the class of the empty set. And I get an equivalence class which acts like a one of what I hope is going to be a ring. And that's the equivalence class of a single point. And I'm going to have this set up so I have enough functions around so that certainly any point will map to any other point, so they're all in the same equivalence class. Now, the way I've set up is not quite a ring. I think it's, there are issues about whether this addition is defined everywhere. So we'll just put a little bit more structure on this. We define a slightly different equivalence relation on the class of this collection of sets. And I'll say that X double tilde Y, if I can translate by some other set Z, which is disjoint from X and Y, so that then there is a bijection between X union Z and Y union Z. So I give myself this kind of a little bit of translation there, a bit of room to move. And then I'll take the equivalence classes under this equivalence relation. So I've made a few more things equivalent because I've allowed myself to move a little bit by this set Z. And then the Grothendieck ring of the class of sets and the class of functions is the ring generated by these equivalence classes. So I have this addition operation, I have a multiplication, I've got a natural zero and a natural one, and putting all this together, I get a ring. Okay, I could get a ring generated by these equivalence classes. So, what does this look like? What can we do with it? I started out talking about an infinite pigeonhole principle, then I've constructed this ring sort of out of nowhere. What's the connection? The connection is that the Grothendieck ring of the given class of sets with the given class of functions is non-trivial if and only if that class of sets and functions has the pigeonhole principle. And this is a nice argument to work through, so let's go ahead and do it. What does it mean for the Grothendieck ring to be non-trivial? Well, for any ring, to be non-trivial means that 1 is different from 0. And given what 1 is the equivalence class of a point, and 0 is the equivalence class of the empty set, so the 1 is not equal to 0, just in case these two things are not the same equivalence class, which is to say that a point, the set of a point is not equivalent to the empty set. Well, thinking about what our equivalence relation is, that says there is no set Z in S which is disjoint from the empty set, but everything is disjoint from the empty set, for which there's a bijection between the set Z union the point and Z union the empty set. All right, that's my definition. Well, let's just translate that a little bit. That means there is no set W for which there's a bijection between the set W and itself minus a point. That's my pigeonhole principle. So in order to understand this or have an idea about whether a certain class of sets can have a pigeonhole principle, we can look instead at the structure of this ring, the Grothendieck ring, and find out if it's non-trivial. But actually, the structure of this ring, even if it is non-trivial, it's also interesting to say, what is that ring? And so that's kind of what the question is, or was. What is the Grothendieck ring of various classes of sets? Now, there's a question about where do I get reasonable classes of sets and reasonable classes of functions about which to ask this question. I was very vague. I said, just take a big class of sets, a big class of functions. It's okay to do that, but it only gets interesting when those sets that you're talking about have some other context, have some other reason to be interesting. Just sort of putting together a class of sets for no particular reason is, well, so what? Right. So let's see where we have natural ways of coming up with such classes of sets, which is a good question to ask. And this is where the model theory comes in. So I just want to give a very kind of quick overview of what model theory is, just for those who don't know, so you know what kind of where all this is coming from. Model theory is a branch of mathematical logic, and so what we do in logic is to look at the underlying logic in mathematics. So the things that we talk about, the things that we say mathematically, and say, what is that logic, what can we say? So in any kind of mathematical formula, whenever you're making a statement in mathematics, you have certain what we call the basic connectives that make up the statements of what you say. You say and, you say or, you say implication, if then, if something is true, then something else is true. We talk about negation, something's not true. We have quantifiers, we say for all variables x in a certain region, something or other. Or we say there is a variable x for which something or other is true. And then we talk about variables x, y, and z. And we say equals. And some people think of equals as being a logical formula, and some people think of it as being part of the language. I'm going to put it in as very basic. I don't want to deal with not talking about equals. So we'll always have equals there. Then when we're talking about a particular kind of mathematical structure, you know, in a particular mathematical situation, we have the parts of the things that we say which are particular to the context. So if I'm talking about a group, then I need to talk about the group operation, the multiplication. I need to talk about the group identity. If I'm talking about a field, I need to have two operations, a plus and a times. I need to have two identities, 0 and 1. If I'm talking about a group, it doesn't make sense to have another operation. It doesn't make sense to talk about plus. So that doesn't, to have an operation like plus, doesn't fit with the language of groups. The language of groups is just talking about times and 1. If I'm in a field, then I have another operation. I might be in an ordered field. I might be interested in also asking about whether x is less than y. Again, in some fields, that's a natural thing to say, and it belongs in the language, like a real closed field, like the real numbers. And in some fields, it doesn't, like an algebraically closed field, the complex numbers. It doesn't make sense to talk about something being less than something else. So what particular things, kinds of things I want to say depends on the context in which I'm working. So we have what's called the pieces of the language which are dependent on the context that we're working in. Then a structure consists of a set over which the variables range. So I have my x, y, and z. They've got to be in something in order for it to make sense. And then an interpretation of these symbols in the language. I have a particular group, say the dihedral group, and then I have an interpretation of what I mean by times in that context. It's the function composition. I have an interpretation of the symbol, which is the identity, which is the identity function. If I'm working in a field, I would also want to interpret, say, the ordering in some context. So a structure consists of a particular set and then a particular interpretation of the pieces of the language in that context. And then we can say various things. We can build formulas in the language. We use the logical symbols plus what's that language which is relevant to the context that we're looking at. And we say things. So we say, for all x, for all y, and for all z, x times z plus y equals x times z plus x times y, the distributive law. Or I might say for all x, if x is not equal to 0, then there is a y such that x times y equals 1. Every non-zero element has an inverse. Or I might say there exists a z such that x squared plus z squared equals 1. Okay, these are all different things that I can write down. Notice there's a slight difference between the third example and the first two. In the first two, every variable is quantified. I said for all x, or there is a y. I'm saying, making some assertion about what I want to be true about that variable. In the third one, I haven't said anything about x. I said there is a z, such that x squared plus z squared equals 1. Well, in this case, I could be, I could worry about what do I mean by that? What can I mean by saying this formula, or what can I mean by asking whether or not it's true? And actually, it doesn't make sense to say is this true or not, because, well, it depends on what you allow x to be. So let me hold off on that on carrying on with that idea for a moment. These formulas of this kind are called sentences. They have no free variables. Their variables are all bound by a quantifier. A formula of this kind is said to have a free variable. I can write down, if I'm in a situation, I have a structure, I've chosen a language, I have a structure which is appropriate for that language, so I have a set, I understand what my functions and relation symbols mean. I can then, and I write down a bunch of axioms. Well, I write down a bunch of sentences. I can say, are those sentences true in that particular structure? And if they are, then I will say that the structure is a model for those axioms, all right, those sentences. And if they're not true, then I'll say it's not a model. So the sort of situation that we're interested in is when we have a structure which is a model for a particular collection of sentences. And if I'm in that situation, so, for example, the complex numbers with the appropriate interpretations of plus and times and 0 and 1 is a model of the field axioms. On the other hand, if I take polynomials over in one variable over the complex numbers, it's no longer a model for the field axioms. The axiom that says every non-zero element has an inverse is not true. Right? So it's just not true in that context. Okay, but there's still the question about what about those formulas with free variables in? It doesn't make sense to ask whether or not they're true because I haven't said what about their free variable. Well, let's look in the situation where I have M, and sometimes sort of in model theory there's a convention that you use a cursive letter for a structure which consists of a set and then over which the variables range and then interpretations of the symbols in the language. So let's suppose we have M, which is a structure for a language L. Then we say that a subset X in the universe, M to the N, is definable if there is some formula with free variables such that X consists of those points X for which the formula is true. So going back to that example that we had before, actually I have some examples coming up, but there, if I take this formula, there exists a z such that x squared plus z squared equals 1, then I'm looking at for those x's for which it's true that there is a z such that x squared plus z squared equals 1. And if I asked about this in the real numbers, then I would have, I think I have the things which are between zero, net minus 1 and 1, but I'd have to do a subtraction. I can't do that in my head. Okay, so I got some more examples here. Oh, yeah, there it is, right there. I forgot that was coming up. Okay, so I have exactly this example. If I look in the real numbers for those x's for which there exists a z, such as z squared plus x squared equals 1, then this is exactly the set of x such that x is between negative 1 and 1. Okay, that's something we know about the real numbers. Or I can look in the set of x in the complex numbers for which there exists a z such that x squared plus z squared equals 1. In this case, I get everything. Everything of the form z squared equals 1 minus x squared always has a solution. Or I can look at the set of x in the polynomial ring over the complex numbers for which there exists a y such that x times y equals 1, those elements which are invertible. I know it's not everything, so it is an example of a definable set in that context. It's always good to look at, when you're looking at a definition, you look at an example, and then you look at an example for which it doesn't hold. So let's just look over here. If I look at the set of points x, y, and r2 for which y is equal to sine of x, the graph of the sine function, this is not definable just in the field language. I need something more in order to get at this set. I can't define it just using plus and times. Okay? The sine function isn't definable. Okay, so I have this notion. This gives me a huge collection of sets, the definable sets in a structure with a given language. And this is a very natural collection of sets for study in different contexts. The sets which arise naturally in model theory, and of course when model theory gets interesting in connection with other parts of mathematics, is when the definable sets, the ones that you can work on from a model theoretic point of view, turn out to be the same as the collection of sets that you look at for some other reason. Right? So for example, it turns out the constructible sets in algebraic geometry are exactly the definable sets in an algebraically closed field. So that's where we start getting these ties. We say that a function is definable if its graph is a definable set. So that gives me a collection of functions which is very naturally associated with the class of definable sets. And then I can then look at the Grothendieck ring of the structure. So the Grothendieck ring of a structure M is the Grothendieck ring as we defined it for the class of definable sets and the class of definable functions. Okay, so now I have some natural places to look at the Grothendieck ring. We can ask, what is the Grothendieck ring in various different contexts? So going back to my first example, if I take M to be simply a finite set, and I'll just have no language at all. Okay, so just I have a structure with no language except equality, and I just take a finite set. So in order to think about what the Grothendieck ring is, we have to think, what is the class of definable sets in this case? There's not much that you can say in an empty language. You can say that X equals something, or you can say that X is not equal to something, and you can string those together with ands and ors, but that's about it. That's really all you can do. So the definable sets, well, we have two cases. The first one in which my set only has one element, that's pretty boring. Any definable set is either empty or contains that one element, and my class of functions is just is also not very much. But actually, we do get a non-trivial Grothendieck ring just because there's so little going on here, but it's not very interesting. And if we have more than one element, then basically our finite sets are finite. They can be arbitrarily large. The only way you can define a function is that you can just say it takes this element to that element, and that's all you can say. So, but you can at least you can distinguish between your finite sets based on the number of elements. So the Grothendieck ring is the integers. It's the smallest set which acts as a counting set. It has to be a ring, of course. Remember, it's the ring generated by the equivalence classes of these sets. So it's more than just the natural numbers. It's a ring. So we get the negative ones as well. Okay, things get a little more interesting if I take an infinite set. But again, no language. Now, with no language, I'm really stuck. You know, there's not much I can do. Again, basically what I can do is I can list the elements of the set. I can say X is equal to one of a finite number of things. Or I can say X is not equal to one of a finite number of things, and that gives me the complement of a finite set, a cofinite set. If I have do this for n variables, if I look in a definable subset of I to the n, I can look at their projections in each coordinate. These have to be either finite or cofinite. How can I define a function? Well, all I can do is say what it's equal to, but I can only say that at finitely many points. So again, definable functions are the identity, except at finitely many points. What is the Grothendieck ring? You know, I don't have very many functions here. And if I have few functions, that means that the Grothendieck ring gets big. Because the Grothendieck ring, of course, is these equivalence classes of sets which are equivalent when there's a bijection between them. If I don't have enough functions, then I don't get very many bijections, and so my equivalence classes are small, and so I get a lot of, potentially a lot of elements in the Grothendieck ring. I'm going to leave you to think about what this ring might be. And let's actually have something which is with a little bit more content. Things get more interesting if I add a little bit more language, right? So we can look at the natural numbers, so an infinite set, with now a function on it, the successor function. The successor function takes x to x plus 1. Well, the successor function is a function from the natural numbers to the natural numbers without the zero. These two sets, therefore, are in bijection, and the pigeonhole principle fails. Right? So the Grothendieck ring of the natural numbers with the successor function is 0. All right, let's have something a little bit more interesting still. Let's take the complex numbers, an algebraically closed field, or in fact any algebraically closed field, with the field structure, plus and times 0 and 1. Then the easy formulas to build are polynomials. Okay, I can use plus and times and constants from my from the complex numbers, and I can build a polynomial. And then what can I say about it? Well, once I've built a polynomial, I don't have any relations in my language. So the only things I can say are a polynomial equals 0, or a polynomial is not equal to 0. So the definable sets that I get are just the 0 sets of polynomials or their complements. Well, those are definable without quantifiers. I didn't put any quantifiers in. I just said a polynomial is equal to 0. When I put a polynomial in, then what I do is when I put a quantifier in, say an existential quantifier, what I'm actually doing is projecting. If I say, look at the set of x, y such that, I'm sorry, look at the set of x such that there exists a y such that p of x, y equals 0, what I'm doing is looking at the zero set of p of x, y, and then I'm projecting onto the first coordinate. I'm looking at those x for which there is a y up above, which takes me down here. So that's a projection of a variety or of a constructible set. Well, it turns out there's a big theorem which one can think of either as a theorem in algebraic geometry called Chevalier's theorem or as a theorem in model theory that, in fact, any set which is definable with quantifiers is definable without quantifiers. So the constructible sets that I could conceivably get by adding projection are just the ones that I get using unions and intersections and complements. I don't get anything more by taking projections, or I don't get anything more by adding in the quantifiers. So the sets that were the definable sets, the class of sets that we're talking about in this context, are exactly the constructible sets. And axis theorems tells us that the Grothendieck ring is non-trivial. Right? We have a pigeonhole principle, the Grothendieck ring is non-trivial. Well, given that it's non-trivial, we can ask the question, what is it? And this was looked at by Dinesh and Lazare, and they proved that there is a surjection from the Grothendieck ring, in this context, to a polynomial ring in two variables. But at this point, that's all we know about the Grothendieck ring. We don't know what it is. All we know is that there's a surjection to this polynomial ring. So it's pretty big. It's, you know, has this kind of richness and complicated nature to it, but we don't actually know what it is. And that's an interesting question in the context of motivic integration. This is where Andenef and François Lazare came in to ask that question. Well, model theoretically, when we look at something for algebraically closed fields, we then go on and say, well, what about real closed fields or the reals? So when I'm looking at the reals, it's natural to work with the field operations and the ordering, because the ordering is, you know, it's intrinsic to the way we think about the reals that there is this order on them. And so we can ask in this case, well, okay, do we get a pigeonhole principle? What is the Grothendieck ring? And again, model theoretically, we can generalize this to not just the reals, but any real closed field, because we're not really thinking about, in this language, we're not thinking about completeness properties of the reals. There's a theorem of van den Dries that says that there's a definable bijection between two definable sets in this language, if and only if they have the same dimension and the same Euler characteristic. Now, I didn't want to take the time to tell you about what Euler characteristic is in this context, but let's take it as being it's a certain measure of a kind of complexity of a set. And actually, as we'll see, it's really essentially the it's element in the Grothendieck ring. And the dimension is what you would think dimension ought to be. If you have a set sitting in R to the n, then the dimension measures it could be just, you know, a surface sitting in R2, that should have dimension 1, because if you project it to R1, then it contains an open set. So it's the largest, the dimension of a set is the largest case that you can project into RK and have it contain an open set. So what this theorem says in the language that I've set up so far is that two definable sets in this context are in the same equivalence class if and only if they have the same dimension and the same Euler characteristic. But actually what follows is that they're in the same equivalence class if and only if they have the same Euler characteristic. We lose the dependence on dimension. Let's see how that happens. Suppose that we have two sets which have the same Euler characteristic but different dimension, dimension of x less than the dimension of y. I can choose a set z which is disjoint from both x and y, for which the dimension of z is the same as the larger of the two dimensions. And if I look at the dimension of the union, well, thinking about that notion of projection, if I have a set which has a flat bit and then a box, its dimension is determined by the large bit. Right? We ignore the flat bit from that point of view. So the dimension of the union will just be the dimension of the larger piece, which in this case is z, and the dimension of y union z will just be, they have the same dimension. I can't force the dimension to go up by taking a union, so they have, the dimension stays the same. But the Euler characteristic of x union z will be the Euler characteristic of x plus the Euler characteristic of z. That's part of the definition of an Euler characteristic, that it has that additivity property. That will be the Euler characteristic of y plus the Euler characteristic of z. I'm sorry, but I assume that the Euler characteristic of x and the Euler characteristic of y are the same, so that gives me the Euler characteristic of y union z. So y union z and x union z are sets which have the same Euler characteristic and the same dimension, so by van der Waals' theorem, there actually is a bijection between them, and since there's a bijection between x union z and y union z, then x and y have the same class, or the same class in the equivalence relation. So this shows that if the Euler characteristics are the same, then they have the same class. We can argue similarly to see that if they're in the same class, then they have the same Euler characteristic. So the equivalence class is determined just by the Euler characteristic, which is a number, an integer number, or an integer, positive or negative. And therefore, the Grothendieck ring is the integers. So we have this different situations. The algebraically closed field, the Grothendieck ring is really quite complicated, and we don't know what it is. Here, the Grothendieck ring is very simple. It's just the integers. Well, I got into this because Dinesh and Lozera at a conference were talking about this notion of the Grothendieck ring and asked the question, what about the p-adics? Right, so if we have, again, model theoretically, we do things for the algebraically closed field, for the real closed field, and for a p-adically closed field. There's sort of three paradigm situations that we want to look at. So the question is, what is the Grothendieck ring of the p-adics in the natural language? So the p-adic numbers form a field. So we have the field operations 0 and 1. And we also have a valuation, which is a kind of a notion of size, but does not work like an ordering. And there's a theorem by Serre, which one can restate in this terminology, which says that the Grothendieck ring of the category of p-adic analytic manifolds looks like z mod p minus 1z. So here I'm restricting my sets. I'm not looking at all definable sets. I'm looking actually at those sets which are p-adic analytic manifolds. And I'm also restricting my class of functions. I'm looking at the functions which are analytic functions from an analytic manifold to another one. So in this case, we get this z mod p minus 1. And so the question was, well, what if we look at the definable sets instead? So we have a larger category of functions and a larger category of sets, but something which is more intrinsic to the algebraic language of the p-adics. And so the thought was that, well, probably it would be z mod p minus 1z. But it turns out, no. It turns out the Grothendieck ring is trivial in this case. And what this means is that, well, it means that we have a lot of functions. There are a lot of definable functions around which give us enough bijections to force the Grothendieck ring to be trivial. So I have 20 minutes. I think I have time to, maybe I have 10 minutes, a 50-minute talk. All right. I've got time to tell you a little bit about the proof of this theorem, which I think is quite nice because it shows you, it brings in a lot of the sort of context of the p-adic numbers. So I'll tell you a little bit about what the p-adic numbers are, just to for those of you who don't know and might just give a little sense of what's going on. So first of all, the best way to, in the context of this talk, the easiest way to think about a p-adic number is as an infinite series So the sum from I equals m to infinity of ai t to the I, and from, of course, from the point of view of the reals, this looks like a rather badly divergent series because I have these p's. P is a fixed prime. And if I have, of course, so that I'm thinking my powers of p getting larger and larger. So this is an infinite sum for which the powers of p are getting larger. But in the p-adding numbers, what we do is we have a notion of size. The valuation measures the divisibility by p. And I say that a number is small if it's divisible by a large power of p. So from the point of view of the p-adding metric, these are actually getting smaller because they're divisible by higher and higher powers of p. So this is a convergent sum. And then we have m is going to be some integer. So I can have them starting with negative powers of p, and then they go off to infinity. The coefficients, I should say, are... the coefficients are in the set 0, 1, up to p minus 1. Okay. So if I put in something larger than p, then I get forces it into the latent term. Okay, so then we can look at, very naturally, we look at a subring of the field, which is the what's called the p-adding integers. Those p-adding numbers for which the valuation is greater than or equal to 0. So if this is an element of qp, if I look into zp, then x must be the sum as I goes from 0 to infinity of ai, p to the I. So those for which the sum starts at 0. Okay, so what I'm going to do is look at the set of the p-adic integers and show that the class of the p-adic integers is the same as the class of the p-adic integers minus the point 0. And then that will give me the triviality of the Grothendieck ring. All right, so the class of 0 will be equal to the class of the empty set. So we need to know, in order to show that these two classes are the same, we need to know what definable bijections we have around. So what way can I get a bijection from one set to another? So we can very easily see that if I can go from the p-adic integers to those integers of the form 1 plus p times zp. What that means is I'm multiplying something like this by p and then adding 1. So I'm looking for those p-adic integers which start with a 1 instead of starting with anything else, with potentially anything else. And that there's a bijection between those two sets, which is just x goes to 1 plus p times x. Because I've cut it off at 0, this is a bijection. If I had been taking all of the p-adic numbers, then this would not be, I wouldn't be going to a proper subset of myself by doing this. So it's because I cut them off that I can do that nicely. So that means that these two sets are in the same class. Okay, so let's look at some sets that we have around. This set X is the set of those p-adic numbers which have a p minus 1th root. It's those x for which there exists a y such that y to the power p minus 1 is equal to x. And here we're asking about, you know, what kind of roots do I have? What kind of equations can I solve? Now notice that if I take some x which has a p minus 1th root, and if its value is equal to 0, that means it starts at the 0 point. So its first term... I'm taking some x equals a0 plus a1 times p, etc. If it has that a0, which is a non-zero term, and if it has a p minus 1th root, then that non-zero term must actually be 1. And that comes from Fermat's little theorem, which says that if I take an element of the set 0 through p minus 1 and take it to the power p and get back itself, it must have been 1. Let me say that again. If I take an element, a naught plus a1p and so on, take it to the power p minus 1, I'll get 1. A naught to the power p minus 1 is congruent to 1 mod p. Okay. So anything which has a p minus 1th root has to actually be starting with 1. On the other hand, if I take something which has a p minus 1th root and its value is strictly greater than 0, then its value has to be at least p minus 1. Because if I take something of the form, something like this, and it has a p minus 1th root, well, all of these intermediate terms don't have a p minus 1th root. I have to go all the way up to p to the power p minus 1 in order for it to have a p minus 1th root. So I just can't get anything lower down. So I have this gap. So I get two disjoint. I can break my x into two disjoint sets, those for which the value is equal to 0 and those for which the value is greater than 0. And so I can rewrite that as things of the form 1 plus p times zp, and the disjoint union with those things with actually values strictly greater than or equal to p minus 1. So the class of x is, this is a disjoint union, so the class of x is the class of 1 plus p times zp plus the class of those things of value greater than or equal to p minus 1. Well, there's a map from x to x greater than or equal to p minus 1, which is just take anything and multiply by p to the power p minus 1. Now send us from one to the other, that's 1 to 1 and on to, so these two have the same class, therefore the class of the p-adic integers is 0. Okay, that's one piece of my argument. Now I need to show that the class of zp without 0 is also 0. Here we get a little bit more technical. You're just going to have to take me on faith with some of these parts. We look at another definable set. It's those elements which are in zp without 0 which have a square root. There exists a y such that y squared equals x. Well, it turns out that we can write this as the disjoint union of, it has four cosets, essentially. There's those things which have a square root, or two times those things which have a square root. And the image here, again, is to look at this way of writing out a p-adic number and ask what has to be true in order for it to be a square root. And there's something called Hensel's lemma, which says that a p-adic equation has a solution in the p-adics just in case when you reduce it mod p, you get a solution in the p-adic integers. So you only have to look at the first term to ask whether or not it has a solution, and then you just look in the set zp, the coefficients 0, 1, 2 up to p minus 1, to ask whether or not this has a square root. And you can divide that into two groups, those which do have a square root and those which don't. Then, going up one step, if you have a 0 there but you have a p here, well, you don't get a square root, because the p doesn't have a square root. So you have to go up to p squared. So I can actually break my set of elements which have a square root into four separate groups, and they have, which are determined by essentially a coset representative, so of the form 2p and 2p, or this is for p not equal to 2. If p is equal to 2, it's slightly different. They all look like y. There's the map multiplied by 2 or multiplied by p, which takes me from one to the next. So this says that the class of zp without 0 is exactly 4 times the class of y. We've got 4 copies of y there. On the other hand, I can look at this differently and say, well, the squaring function is a 2 to 1 map on zp without 0. So I can look at zp without 0 as a disjoint union of things which have a square root or things which are minus a square root, which are minus something which has a square root. And then we need a little bit of model theory, which says that there's a definable function which chooses a square root. So there is, in fact, a definable function, a one-to-one and onto function, which is definable from the set y to the set of square roots, and then, of course, to the other one as well, because that's multiplied by minus 1. So, in fact, zp without 0 is the same as 2 times y. Okay, but I've got these two equations relating zp without 0 and y. Subtracting, I see that zp without 0 is equal to 0. And now, so then, therefore, I'm done. And then the corollary of the proof is that we can actually find, I mean, I haven't given it to you, but we can find an explicit bijection between zp and zp without 0. Okay, I'm done.